This is a forum, which usually at Holden, as veterans know, takes place at 9 o'clock in the evening. But everything is a little bit topsy-turvy on the 4th of July. And we thought it would be an appropriate way to begin Holden's celebration of 4th with some time for reflection about what this day is and the variety of perspectives and meanings that Independence Day has for us all. We were reminded already at the flag raising that this day commemorates a revolution, in fact. And also at the flag raising, we were reminded that there are other documents and other sets of relationships on the globe that are important. Along with the Star Spangled Banner, those of you who weren't at the flag raising, we were blessed with a rendition of a cantata based on the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And that cantata was sung by an opera singer in both English and Russian. So already, Holden's way of getting at the 4th of July is a little bit different than a lot of other places, at least. We want to talk about love of countries this morning. There's something almost, I think, archaic about the topic. We talk about patriotism in an age when, at least in our church life and a lot of the rest of our lives, that kind of masculine Latin root, patria, is offensive to lots of people. We don't talk very much about matriotism, do we? That's one way in which talking about patriotism is already, for some ears in the room, an archaic thing to do. But we don't need to, I think of ourselves if we are questioning the way in which a variety of approaches to love of country is appropriate. We don't have to think about that as something that's only popping up in the last decade or two. We can be reminded, for instance, that it was the 18th century, probably at least in Western Europe and in England, which provided us with most skeptical views of the love of country. It was Samuel Johnson in the 18th century who told us that patriotism was the last refuge of scoundrels. Right? And it was Alexander Pope in the same century who said that there was that a patriot is a fool in every age. Right? Things didn't get a whole lot better in the 19th century, although as industrial reality broke onto Western Europe and then onto England and the United States, you had people like William Brown in the United States saying that no man, no person can be a patriot.
There it is.
No man can be a patriot on an empty stomach. And then I'll leave the comparison of priests and religion to Carol.
That's a good one. I'll read it.
The modern and skeptical view of both religion and the state was captured by Justice Holmes early in this century, who said that priests are no more necessary to religion than politicians to patriotism.
Here.
So if we have skeptics in the room about the question of love of country, if we have lots of different points of view on what love of country may mean, we are not alone, nor is that that discussion new. And it's certainly a discussion that's appropriate to hold on. Well, what we've done this morning is to ask five people to begin our discussion with very brief thinking out louds for us to take off from. Kit and Paul and Carol and Steve and Ann, you can choose any order you want to, because your assignment was to think a little bit ahead of time and kick off the discussion with a variety of points of view.
Kit, do you want to just...
Don't want to quiet you down.
Okay.
If he's really good, the rest of us aren't.
I'll try to be brief and bad.
Get Nagel.
I wasn't born in this country, but I carry a U.S. passport and citizenship, and it's something that I value. And there are, of course, many things about the states that are good, many things that are bad. One of the things that I like to talk about is one of the freedoms, and that's the freedom of travel, which the passport provides. We have freedom of travel within the United States. That's something that citizens of other major powers don't necessarily have. We have the ability to cross national borders and go to more than 100 foreign countries. Again, a freedom that many people don't have. And this freedom of travel led me to a life of travel. And I spend about 3 to 4 months a year overseas, not as a tourist, but what the Chinese call a merchant, which is a mixed, it's not exactly a compliment, but it's not a criticism. And I'm always happy to come back home, not just because it's home, and not just because it's a easily understandable language. And the traffic is manageable, and we have good freeways, and the telephones work. But because of certain things that we just are so accustomed to, we don't think about. And I think that to think about why the U.S. is the way it is, and why I like the U.S. And value my citizenship, really has to be in comparison to something else. You know, if we lived in a vacuum, in the United States, we wouldn't have really any yardstick to measure against. And I'd like to compare the life that we have in the States to a country with a population 5 times that of the United States, that of mainland China, where I spend time, which is a society of men, not of laws. There is a tradition, cult of personality under Mao. Similar things happening in North Korea, but I'll address to China. There are very few limits to the arbitrary use of power. And there is, a case can be made, there's very little intellectual honesty. One of my favorite stories about intellectual honesty or freedom or in China is that I'm sure most of you know, occasionally there are purges or reevaluations in the political system where university professors or political leaders are denounced and sent out to learn how to grow rice for a few years and then are rehabilitated a few years later. And Deng has been through this cycle actually twice, the current leader of China. And my favorite story about this revision or denunciation was that after Deng was denounced, they decided to, they had to have a new a book edition for China. And so they did. Every once in a while they rewrite their history. And Deng, in page 208, was denounced as a revisionist, you know, an imperialist toady and whatever. And at this time, Deng was out learning to grow rice. And however, things in China have a momentum and a time of their own, and the printing schedule was delayed, and it took so long that by the time they'd actually got the book in print, Deng had somehow been rehabilitated, and he was no longer a revisionist or a capitalist toady. So they had a dilemma. How could they had to rewrite history again, and the way they did this is pretty incredible. They sent out the same book, but stapled to the front page with instructions to paste this piece of paper over paragraph 4 on page 206, was the paragraph about Deng Xiaoping actually being a person and a great leader of the people and one who has been true to Mao thought for all time. So as you can imagine, going out to the schools and universities of China, this book, and on page 201, one is asked to paste over their vision of history. And that's a pretty, it would be hilarious if he wants to say. And that's something that I think we don't face here. History is, I mean, a case can be made, but intellectual honesty is something that we value here and does exist, and in some other countries it doesn't. As with China, laws change with the political wind. Mao said truth is a political issue, basically a tool. So truth is what is useful to the state, and it's not an objective thing that one values. And just to sort of finish up with, there's a cycle of control and liberalism in China. The most recently, I'm sure you've heard about it, is in Shanghai, where there is a sort of flowering of this constrained liberal thought, and then people demonstrate their freedoms and rights, and then they are occasionally sent off to learn how to grow rice again. Final point on the U.S. is still a major goal, a major goal along with Canada for sanctuary, both political and economic. Again, from the China experience and the Hong Kong experience, so many Chinese are trying to get U.S. and Canadian citizenship prior to 1997, not wanting to get caught behind closed borders, as many of their relatives did in Shanghai after the revolution on the mainland. It's the value, I think, is the United States is in comparison to what we have, and we don't realize what we have as compared to 1.4 billion people behind and not exactly always happy with their situation. And that's my kickoff.
Okay, thank you. I think the transnational nature of the brief introductions will continue. Paul Scott from the Canadian viewpoint.
Well, when Jody asked me last night to join this panel and to discuss the subject of patriotism, that was where the discussion began, and I thought to myself, never thought much about patriotism. That seems to be something that Canadians tend to associate with the U.S., with Great Britain, with Germany, with Russia, some of the major powers in the world, and not so much with Canada. But when he said, we're discussing love of country, well, I could relate to that a little more easily. And I think, I really do love my country. I was born in Canada, raised there, spent most of my life there. I've also lived in the U.S. and enjoyed the 4.5 years that I lived here. But it gives me, I think, a little different perspective, in coming from a country that isn't number one or number two. It doesn't really have to prove that. There isn't much percentage in trying to prove that you're number 36 instead of number 37. So that love of country tends to take on a little different sort of meaning, I think, for Canadians generally. There are a whole lot of Canadians that look at the U.S. and wish that we had more flag raising and more flag waving and love of country and patriotism. A whole lot of others, I think, that say, gee, I'm glad we don't have to do that because there isn't quite as much to prove. You know, we love our country with a sort of tongue in cheek because it's 3.5 million square miles, most of which are largely uninhabited. It's 25 million people, about a tenth of what there are in the U.S., and it's cold about 7 or 8 months of the year. So when you're talking about love of country, you gotta love that cold as well, and not always do all the time. Most of Canadians, of course, spend more time coming across the north and south border into the States than they do visiting other parts of the country. So it's more of a regionalized kind of country, and yet that's something that makes it a very interesting thing too. When I think of love of country, I think first of all of celebrating and enjoying the things that, that Kit mentioned here earlier. I think some of the same freedom to travel, freedom to express your views, and at least attempt to be honest with them, exist in Canada as well as in the States. And I think of the things that I really like about that country, about my country, is the mosaic, the fact that we do have hyphenated Canadians, Ukrainian Canadians, Chinese Canadians, Lebanese Canadians, and so on. I was talking to Peggy, and I forgot her last name, but I was talking to her earlier this morning, and she mentioned that when she was in Montreal, she had trouble finding somebody that would speak English to her. Now, I know darn well that most of them can and would if they wanted to speak English, but a lot of the people there's a real sort of nationalism that I object to. I think it's an aberration that has come out of the 18th century or wherever that really is a problem. Patriotism probably isn't the problem, it's nationalism that is. But if you go to downtown Toronto, you'll find streets that are labeled in Greek. Other streets are labeled in Chinese, and others in some other language. Really kind of neat to be in that kind of a mosaic. In Edmonton, we have an annual heritage festival that has something like 102 nationalities represented, or people represented there from all over the world, and they celebrate their origins as well as their Canadianness, whatever that means. I think what I like about my country and celebrate is the record of support for the UN, for UN agencies, for its involvement in the Commonwealth of Nations. That's another opportunity for an international forum. For the fact that they have, the government has fairly consistently spoken out in favor of the blacks in South Africa or Namibia, the people of Nicaragua in more recent times, and so on. I think I like the fact we have a few good hockey players. We have the CBC, we have Medicare, which I really enjoy and appreciate, especially when I'm taking medicine for something. But I think it also means being not only well-informed and knowing what's going on in your country and around the world, but also critiquing your country when the time comes to critique it. And there are many times when that does come. And I think at the same time that I'm celebrating and enjoying the things that I like about my country, or that, say, Americans like about their country, we need to be well-informed, not only about what's going on here, but what's going on in the rest of the world. Thinking of the fact that a number of years ago, the UN, I'm not sure which agency or whether it was all of the UN, suggested to the developed nations that they allocate 1% of their gross national product annually for use in relief and development projects around the world. Now, a couple of nations have come pretty close to that. I think Sweden is very close. I think, if I recall, Switzerland, a couple of the other Scandinavian countries, and so on. Canada was up at 0.7%, has slipped down to about 0.5%. I don't like that, and I want to tell my government that, and I do. And a lot of people do the same thing. The U.S., I think, has an even poorer record in terms of the gross national product in relation to its generosity. And there is a lot of generosity, in both of these countries. But we both need to pick up our socks, because we're living really off our prosperity is based in large measure on an economic system that favors us over against the rest of the world. We need to know that and say that to our governments. I need to object when my government says we will test cruise missiles, and I have done that. Not a very popular thing, because most Canadians tend to favor that. We're part of this NORAD agreement with the U.S., and why shouldn't we do our part and so on? But I don't like it. And the same with nuclear subs. Never had. In fact, if any of you know the term West Edmonton Mall, this is the largest mall in the world, they tell me. They have 5 submarines in that mall that you can ride in. That's more submarines than the Canadian Navy has. And I frankly like that. I prefer that. But now they're talking about buying a couple of nuclear subs to sort of keep whoever out of the Arctic. It's probably the Americans at this point, but the Americans and the Russians. We've got to claim sovereignty by having these nuclear subs. It's nonsense. The area where I think we in Canada need to critique our government more than any other, and hopefully a number of us are going to continue to do it, is in our relationship with the first Canadians, the native people. What is Canada? What is the U.S.? A bunch of people who came in here from other parts of the world. The ones that came to Canada first were the native people, the Inuit and the native Indian people. The British, the French, the Scottish, whatever, moved in later and took their land from them. And in a few cases, no treaty was ever signed with anybody. There's a case called the Lubicon Indians in northern Alberta were so isolated that nobody signed any agreements with them. 1939, they finally recognized that and said, yes, you deserve to have your own land, you deserve to have certain rights that come with treaties and so on. Still hasn't happened. What is that, 50 years later? And in the meantime, they discovered oil on that land. So what happened was the government of Alberta said, well, these people don't understand progress. Their definition of progress is moving in and putting the bulldozers in the chief's backyard, which they literally did, and driving away the game and decimating a whole way of life. Now Christians, and thankfully Christian leaders from the major churches across Canada have spoken out on that issue. That's an example of loving your country through critiquing it. I think it's very important. Finally, for me, patriotism or love of country means being an international citizen so that you see your own country in the light of what the needs of the rest of the world are. I think that's so important. Enjoying and critiquing your own country and being well informed about the needs of the rest of the world and participating as an international citizen.
Well, thank you. View from our neighbor to the north. Perhaps an even more foreign country is Southern California. You're a multi.
Well, thank you. I guess I'm sort of excited this morning because it looks like I've got 3 points and I've never preached a 3-point sermon in my life. And that's supposed to be a Lutheran thing. I think that there are several stages that one goes through, and it may be different. Maybe you keep going back and forth between the stages, but I think there are at least 3 stages or developments of love of country. The first is, it's something that all of you, I think, experienced, and that is the love of a particular place. How many of you have read Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck? Have you heard of that kind of appreciation of place? And I think that one of the things that I noticed with particular interest is the people that visit Holden Village, and if they're from the Midwest and the Plain States, their reaction to this incredible look. you can hardly see the sky out of here because we're surrounded by mountains. What that says, I mean, and their reaction is usually that, boy, they feel really closed in and they'd like to see a broad horizon. My reaction is that I've grown up in mountains and I really like it. It feels comfortable. It feels like a giant hug. Particular place is very important. And then I think the next, if you sort of to notice the particularity of that place and you love the familiarity, the seasons and so forth. And then that broadens to other kinds of things like the people that are there and so forth. And then a feeling of protection of that place. When that grows into some kind of understanding of the nation that you live in or the city that you live in even, it seems to me that one reaction is to always think that what we do right here is what's right. And those other people are sort of out there and not concerned. And I think then that's a stage in which we sort of don't see beyond ourselves. When you start looking beyond yourself and begin to see interdependence, what you do here affects what is done someplace else, why then I think that's a very positive thing. And travel, if you've done a lot of travel, you begin to automatically see and do comparisons between your country or your place and where you've traveled. It seems to me that the place where most adults are has to be someplace between seeing some other things, reading about other places, and and doing something about being a corrective to wrongs that you see that exist. And I think that a final stage of love of country has to do with being involved in watching, thinking about, sitting down, but also getting active in writing letters and being concerned about electing people that will represent and the whole country and not just a particular place.
Gerald, thank you.
Yep.
Really, for the past weeks, Steve DeGruy has been sharing with us, I think, in lots of ways, reflections on a very different, but in lots of ways similar set of questions as they arise in the South African context. I particularly wanted Steve to be with us this morning because, although you don't want to draw this parallel too far, it could be that you're dealing with questions of love of country in a revolutionary situation. That may in fact have something in common with what's going on in our own country a little over a couple centuries ago. Steve.
Yeah, I think the dilemma of patriotism is really illustrated in a situation like South Africa. Because, just for example, in South Africa we have two national anthems. I think that's a good symbolic way to start. We have the white national anthem, which is the national anthem. And we have the black national anthem, which is sung by more than the white is, but it's not the national anthem. And I think that's a good illustration in terms of the fact that there's competition over the meaning of patriotism, the meaning of love of country. And especially for a white South African who grows up in a community that's opposed to apartheid and who comes to some kind of self awareness about that, there's a real struggle with where and how does one turn and make decisions. I remember in high school we sing the national anthem, I think once a week we're supposed to sing it, and choosing in about the equivalent of 9th or 10th grade not to sing it and having to deal with teachers and that who couldn't understand all of that. For so many people, it just didn't raise any kinds of ethical issues about what does it mean to sing this? What do the words actually mean? And I think it's a pilgrimage that one goes through, perhaps those stages, to come to the point maybe that patriotism or love of country is something that has to do with the people, has to do with the spirit of a country, rather than with any particular government or form of government that a country might take on in any historical given moment. I think too often we take photographs and capture a historical process at a certain point and say that this is how it's always been and this is how it always will be. And it's often the people in power who like to take that photograph because it captures them at their zenith and it puts them in that position. But I think patriotism, especially in the South African context, for me, is a very decided rejection of this present government and system. And people often say to me, especially American patriots, and perhaps people who get on my nerve the most, I mean, not American patriots, but the people who ask this question, you know, why do you want to go back? Isn't America such a wonderful country? Well, I'll deal with the second statement a little later. But people just don't understand that there's a country and a place gives one meaning, and I think I've had to identify that as some kind of form of primitive patriotism. But let me leave that there. I think one of the things I wanted to raise here is the use of patriotism. I hold to a social theory of understanding society, which is best understood perhaps as a conflict analysis, and that says that in any given room, or in any given society, people are in conflict with one another. It's an analysis that can only come from the bottom up, because it's people at the bottom who know they've been sat upon. Whether it's the people who write the textbooks, and who make the television shows, and who control the newspapers, who see it from the top. And for them, society is functional, it's working well. And I think patriotism is one of those things that helps cover over conflicts and tensions. I remember very detailed analyses of Margaret Thatcher's invasion of the Malvinas Islands off Argentina, known as the Falklands in the English-speaking world. And it became very clear that to deal with unemployment, to deal with criticisms of her situation, she had to drum up a whole lot of British flag raising and waving. And I often wonder, in a society where women are oppressed by men, where poor people are oppressed by rich people, where blacks are oppressed by whites, where rural economies are oppressed by city economies, why, you know, the use of patriotism to actually get everybody behind you is such a powerful thing. And it, you know, the statement that no one can be a patriot on an empty stomach makes a lot of sense, but actually there are a lot of patriots on an empty stomach, and often they make the best patriots because they're promised food if they are patriots. I mean, it kind of becomes the carrot. And all the evils and the problems of this country are from outside. And so poor farmers in Tennessee are more concerned about the Russian menace than about the fact that the Americans on Wall Street are absolutely destroying their economy. And that's what patriotism does. And that's why people at Wall Street like it. The second point I wanted to raise is the question of authority and allegiance. And it's interesting, the three responses we've had. Point out to me the most interesting thing about America is that there's actually very little theologizing about the question of patriotism. I think all three responses have been out of a secular... I mean, all the people are Christians, and that's the context, but most of the responses are from within the political theories of pragmatism or whatever, liberalism, whatever. But I really think it comes down to this question of allegiance and authority. And that's a question for Christians of faith, of where does God fit into this picture. Even if we do have the best system in the world, does that mean that God has sanctioned it, or that God and somehow the system have come together? Perhaps it is a stark contrast between the country or God. I think a struggle for many Christians in various parts of the world, and some Christians even here in America that I've had the privilege of meeting, people in the sanctuary movement, that in fact the country is opposed to what God would have them do. Maybe it's more a case, and I don't know on this, that it's the country in God that somehow we love and appreciate this country for what it's given and done for us, but always in the context of our faith in God. And that it's not my country right or wrong, but if the country is wrong, then we have to take a stand against it. I think some of those points that were raised about Canada are so important. And seeing that the rest of the citizens aren't doing it, perhaps Christians have a particular responsibility to always be saying there is a higher way. And so for me, perhaps the two things from what I've said, the use of patriotism to cover conflicts and the question of authority and allegiance, lead me to wonder at the end of my stay here in the United States whether the two things that American Christians really need to be working on in terms of patriotism are firstly social analysis and secondly theology. And in social analysis is not just to assume that things are as they seem, but to ask questions. I think America, perhaps like China, does rewrite history, does cover up things. You know, I was in the Dominican Republic, and United States Marine troops landed to help the Dominican Republic in a time of crisis, from the American history point of view. From the Dominican point of view, American troops invaded to take control of the country and to put down a popular democratic uprising. And so truth is... So it isn't some kind of objective thing up there. It is controlled by the people who published the textbooks. So I think social analysis has to happen. I think we have to ask the hard questions. Why are there 30 million people below the poverty line in the United States? Those are the questions you have to ask. And then theologize. I really do think that it's the one area that American Christians are way behind the rest of the world, is actually asking those hard faith questions about their country. I think the assumption that God put America first and God is behind America is rubbish. but I think it's so strong that people just haven't been able to theologize and say, is that the case? And I would say, out of my experience in South Africa, having to take the hard-nosed social analysis questions and the theology questions, I'm not forcing that on you, and I'm not demanding that you do it, but as a friend and as a fellow traveler, saying perhaps those are areas that we could suggest people look at.
Steve, thank you. Last word often falls to journalists. To journalists, and you've got one. Anne?
I'm not going to bring a journalist's impression, however, just more of a feelings point of view. I'm glad there were such good, succinct, thoughtful responses. First, I felt a very strange stirring at the flag raising when there was a discussion, a brief discussion of the Fourth Commandment read. And I really like, before the flag is raised, to hear, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me." First. But when Jody asked me to talk about love of country, I think of love as being a very mixed up, unreasonable emotion that it's difficult to analyze and say, well, my love works this way or my love works that way. It's a stirring up. And I know that I personally am very susceptible to color, music, marching, and banners, and I have to look closely at myself when that kind of those kinds of attachments are made to things that I don't really believe in or that are chauvinistic. So for me, it's a weak point. I know I, no matter what the cause, my leaning would be to be out there marching if the drums and the color were there. And I have to work very hard at thinking through the philosophies that those drums and colors represent. For me, a nation or a people that I love, represented by my country, takes a number of different forms. I believe that we have a good system in this country, philosophically and in terms of its doctrine and law. I think it is a good one. I'm willing to defend it in arguments. I don't believe it should be static. It isn't, as we heard the Declaration of Independence, that was all radical change. And what the system that we have and other countries have need to be flexible and open to change and betterment when that comes. What we have isn't all there is. There's more, and the kind of expectation that you have for a family or for your friends or for the people you love can be like that for your country, which you love. I think of my love for my country, I was associating with my love for my family or my very good friends, because for those people, that love, one of the things that love generates is high expectations. I expect more from my family and from my good friends. They are people in whom I have an investment. I also expect more of my country. I think its system is the right one. So I also want that to be reflected in its governance, in its relationships to neighbors and to the rest of the world, and its expression of leadership. I have higher expectation of American values and American relationships than I do of other countries. They're not my concern. My concern is my family, my people, my country. So I want righteousness out of my country, and where another kind of emotion, and maybe a better one, is stirred is when my country's actions are not reflecting the ideals that I think they should represent. And so there's a tension, and it's especially apparent when traveling abroad. I've traveled quite a bit and spent a good deal of time in other countries and witnessed other expressions of love of country and experienced the uncomfortable position of being an American who often thinks that our way is the right way or the God-ordained way, and other people don't think so. But it makes for good conversation, and two people who both love their country can have a good discussion if they aren't caught up in the chauvinistic idea that God loves us best. God doesn't love us best. I really don't believe that. But it is the way the perception comes out many times. Another thing that I need to criticize when I'm being thoughtful is the possessiveness. You know, a popular song when I was about in junior high, very popular in Israel and very popular in this country, was the theme from Exodus, where the lyric went, "This land is mine, God gave this land to me." That's still a very popular song in Israel and always will be, probably. But I much better like the expression of the folks on that I thought of when someone mentioned John Steinbeck. This land is your land, this land is my land. With a free-flowing kind of sharing and willingness to give and hospitality as well. So a lot of my thinking comes from an emotional point of view, since love is an emotion. Patriotism is extremely emotional and it requires care, but I think in the right direction, a critical expression can be joyful.
Anne, thank you. Intention now is to open it up. I think a nice array of international viewpoints on love of the country. Let's add to the array, leap in, responding to anything that any of the five put on the table, or put your own reflections on the table.
Patriotism and nationalism are intended to be a context. In psychological terms, it's the gestalt. It's the perimeter. And I think as a result, from a Christian perspective, it is the reestablishment of Babel. It is the area where man tries to reconstruct meaning after everything has been disarrayed when we challenge the ultimate authority. It is the crash after the fall. And as we try and rebuild some contextual basis for which we can be proud, in the context of an all-powerful, unknowable setting, we lack what is essential, I think, to reaching out and accomplishing the love dimension, and that's fundamental humility. The honest belief that the other person really has something to give, rather than I will help you. And I think in the Christian sense, and one of the reasons we like to come up here on the 4th of July, we know Luther had a terrible problem. It was the notion if we could reestablish the Augustinian koinonia, truth and justice would come and all this corruption from Rome would be out of the way and we'd be a loving fellowship. And then the peasants revolt, so we got to slap them down. It's a hideous example of naivete about the nature of man's creation. And what I really think we have to do in order to build, and I particularly like the one where we're trying to be self-critical. And in fact, from an educational point of view, I'm advocating now that we must understand another country well enough, any country, so that we can critique our own, and from any context. We don't have that. And so it's the context that I think we have to transcend. And one of the things, since the Canadians are here, we tried to do is group of students and I was to put Buckminster Fuller into practice because Trudeau was interested in that. And now with superconductivity, it's a real possibility. That is, his view was the electronic grid, that taking the hydroelectric power of northern Russia and plugging it into that of North America, when the Russians go to bed and we're getting up, if we bombed Russia, our lights would go out. And we need to build the physical means of demonstrating what we can philosophize about. But the context in which we do that oftentimes prevents that. So I really feel that nationalism may be what it is intended to be, a small tower to glorify ourselves. And those have already been rent asunder. And every time we try and reestablish that tower, it becomes a little ludicrous.
Thank you. A word from the global perspective. Others? Yes?
I guess I get disturbed. I'm a comedian as well. When Anne said that, you know, I think that our system is the right one, and also that, you know, I'm concerned about my family, which is American, I'm really not concerned about other countries. And I guess that, for me, is the biggest flaw I see when I come, is that there is a great naivety, there's a great unconcern about the rest of the world, and a great deal of concern about what is going on in America. And the only time the rest of the world is included in that concern is if, for instance, like Nicaragua or something is going on that might impinge on what's going on in America. And I find that very disturbing. I find it sometimes very disturbing, even when I come to Holden, to find out how little, we're the nearest neighbor here, how little people know about, I'm from Edmonton, Alberta. Many people have no idea where that is. I could name most of the states of the Union. I know pretty well where everything is. And it's part of that cultural imperialism that we deal with north of the border. We get all the American television, we get a lot of that. We have McDonald's and everything else. But we have to deal with that, and so we know for, you know, what's going on a great deal. We know all the news items, but I feel very isolated when I come to the States because I never hear, my country could drop off the end of the earth and I'd never know of an American. There was a small item in the Seattle newspaper saying that Canada had voted against the death penalty, and that was a great concern to us while we were here because we knew the vote was coming up, talking about reinstating the death penalty after 20 years of not having it. But it is voted down, and I'm glad for that, but, you know, I may not have even known, and I'm not sure any how many people knew that that even was up for vote there. But it's the kind of thing where I feel isolated sometimes when I come because no one really seems to know or care about what goes on anyplace else but here in the United States. And that, I grieve for that because I think you're missing a great deal.
Over here.
I wanted to tell you that we in Spokane have a public radio, and once a week we get the Canadian version of the news. We have a program, I forget what it's called, but it's the morning news. And it's one thing that I look forward to every single week because I get a different perspective on the news of the world. And I want to, it's wonderful.
Are you personally responsible?
Jody, I want to go back to the image of patriotism as an image of family. Which is a meaningful one for me because it also means that I have a responsibility in terms of what it really is. And that's not something I think we always take seriously. If patriotism is a love of country is in a sense like love of my child, I have participated and contributed to what that child is, and I don't always love what that child's actions are. But there are also times when I can be enormously proud of that. I cannot contribute. I cannot superimpose on others' children what I may attempt to superimpose on mine, which may be the cause of my child's rebellion, for that matter. But I can also care for and enjoy and appreciate what other children are contributing to the whole of the community.
Thank you.
And Carol? But I guess to go with that analogy, Bob, it seems to me that some of the worst embarrassments, however, are not the children of the country, but rather the adults who are taking us in directions that we disagree with. So that our embarrassment is precisely those areas that we see rights denied to people who are not within this country in order for this country to be privileged.
My wife and I have always
agreed. And then when we're faced with that embarrassment, it's really awful. You know, how are we going to do something about that?
Julie, he had his hand up for a while.
Can I put forward a more narrow view of patriotism? We've had a broad view this morning. And it really is what it meant to me when I was a young man in the 40s in England. then we had kept our word in helping Europe, and then got out, or being forced out, and then stood alone. And it's all summed up in a Christian hymn that we used to sing at assembly, at school in the morning, I bow to thee, my country. And I feel that we have an obligation to defend the freedom we enjoy then, and an obligation to those generations in the future to defend the freedom that they should enjoy, that we are now enjoying.
I think I've traveled a great deal and been overseas and been in two of our latest wars as a member of our armed forces. So patriotism is probably something a little different to me. I think in many cases what the gentleman was just talking about, we get confused though when we start thinking of what we're doing to help other people. I spoke Vietnamese fluently. I traveled all over Vietnam. And I think in many cases, we have the greatest of intentions, say in Vietnam, the same as we do in South America now. Some people in our government have the greatest intent to do right in those countries. But sometimes we get confused that only our way is right, and we think, like in Vietnam, we gave the farmers rotor tillers when they were 80 miles from a gas station. I mean, it wasn't very, you know, we gave them steel roofs for their houses where they didn't like it. They didn't like the noise it caused. But I think we have the greatest of intent, but we get confused with our way's the right way, and how we do things, you must do our way. I don't think it's a, I want to think it's not a bully way of saying you have to do things our way. It's one of Big Brother, maybe, you know, you do it our way and that's the way, you know, that we should do it. In most cases, I think it's well intended, but sometimes we get mixed up, depending on who you talk to, of where you come from. Even within here, you know, in 64, Vietnam was very popular. And in 70, you know, they threw, you know, everything at us when we come off the planes when we come back from Vietnam. And it wasn't the military that was involved, I mean, didn't know the cause, it was the politicians. But the way somebody said we don't write, we write political books, we rewrote those political books because in 64, it was the most popular thing going. And in 67, 68, and 69, it was the most unpopular thing. You know, just between those, you know, 4 or 5 years. So I think sometimes we get confused with, you know, what other people really want to do. And I think one of our, if I find a fault with our country, it's trying to impose our values on other people that's probably not ready or not willing or don't want those same values.
Don't like those.
That's a good word too. They don't like those values. I mean, you know, we shipped tons of rice to Vietnam, and it laid on the docks and rotted because they didn't like the type of rice we sent them. You know, and it's the same thing.
Yes, Steve.
One of the interesting things, though, I mean, it's a weird tension because at one level there is that trying to make everybody like us approach, but also from a historical point of view, American foreign policy has so often allied itself with people who are military dictators. And then you start asking the question, well, why? You know, why is, and for me, and I might be a little bit on the rough edge here, but for me, so many of the American freedoms that are lauded around the world, and every other citizen of every other country has them rammed down their heads, are built on the denial of freedom to so many other people. And so I think in the global situation, it is easier to get excited about the freedom. You know, it's almost as if rich people talking to each other and saying, isn't it wonderful we have TVs, we have fridges, and why can't the rest of the world have them? You know, and And yet the precise reason they have them is because the rest of the world doesn't have them.
Global slavery.
Yeah, and it's... and I think also inside the country it becomes more apparent that there are those kinds of tensions. I was very struck in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, at the Norman Rockwell Museum. Two most amazing paintings I've ever really evoked a lot of feeling in me. And the one was, do you know the Rockwell Four Freedoms paintings? And the one painting of the freedom of speech, which is this young farmer with very dirty hands standing up in a New England town meeting, having his say. And in the very next room is a painting called Murder in Memphis. And it's of four students from New York that were killed in Memphis during the civil rights thing. Very stark painting. And there's a real dilemma inside America, and it seems to me that patriotism kind of just washes over all of that. It doesn't allow you to say, look, we killed those people, but we have this, and kind of confuses the issue.
We have time for just a couple more quick comments, and a number of people have been trying to leap in. Michael, I think you were first.
What disturbed me a bit when I encountered American or U.S. American patriotism is that it is quite different from all other attitudes toward your country I encountered in Europe, for example, or even with people from Africa. It's very strange. There is a kind of feeling, I love my country. But if you try to fill that, what does that mean? There are only some abstract things like freedom, which is not much filled with concrete things. What does it mean to have freedom? Or, I mean, what is very strange to me, the flag. That is expression of patriotism. And I think that that has to do with the history of this country and the history of this people, or the non-history.
A couple of quick more. Other people are in line at the coffee, so we couldn't even hear the. So we couldn't even get it. We'll run about two more minutes, very quickly.
It seems to me that in any discussion that I've ever had of patriotism in a fairly large group, that there's generally a real distinction in the perceptions, really depending on the generation in which one is a part. And the history in which we're involved. And in response to your comment, I really do believe that World War II, for instance, was substantively different than anything that has happened in my lifetime. I'm not sure what my response would have been at that time. I really don't know. But I really do think that it really comes down to an issue of defense. And what I hear you talking about is a sense of defense, which I think is different than anything that's, any occasion that's ever happened again in my lifetime. I think we try to rationalize what we're doing in the world in terms of defense. But for me, that makes absolutely no sense. What we're doing in Central America, or what we did in Vietnam or Korea, or those kinds of things, were all couched in terms of our defense. But it's very, very different from what I saw, especially England being involved in World War II. And I think that, unfortunately, those two sets of ideas don't seem to be able to communicate with each other about the differences, about what we mean about defending certain kinds of values and freedoms.
Quickly, Rich.
I just want to say that I'm a father of three children. I live in a small town in Minnesota. And I have a real major problem with the exercise of patriotism in small town America, at least where I live. And that is that I believe that the school district is violating one of the clauses to the Constitution of the United States. I think our school district, and at least in Minneapolis where I grew up also, is forcing patriotism as a form of religious practice in our children. My children are asked to sing the religious songs, which are the Star Spangled Banner. They're asked to stand up and salute the religious icons, which are the flag. They're asked to march in parades, which are processions, worshiping a country, which is God. And as a Christian, I have great conflict with that. I think it's basically illegal. It's the government or it's the school district establishing religion, but it's called patriotism. And it's necessary to defend us from some amoebus, I don't know, what's threatening us, I don't know. But I guess as a Christian, it creates real conflicts because I want my children to become Christians first and identify what their God really is. And the school is constantly kind of forcing this form of religion on my kids.
Let me suggest that we treat the last hour as the opening of conversations that ought to, in fact, mark our celebration of 4th of July for the entire day. I have been impressed with the intergenerational exchange, with the international exchange, and in fact, the beginnings of both social analysis and theology. We should continue that through the day, under the bell, and immediately at breakfast. Thank you.